Hi, Ellie.
Hi, Jenna. How are you?
I am great. And yourself?
I'm great. It's the end of a long day, though.
It is the end of a long day and about time for a pretty spectacular podcast, if
Yeah.
I could suggest it.
Yeah, please do suggest it. We
Yes.
just had a really fun conversation with our friend Emma Zumpson on the topic of neurodivergence.
Yes.
AKA neurodiversity, depending on how you like to call it.
Yes, I've heard it both ways.
Emma is going to school and she's going to be returning to the workforce to be a consultant for companies to learn how to be more inclusive of neurodivergent people and make them feel more seen and understood and feel more comfortable.
Yeah, some great, a really cool opportunity to solve problems in a lot of different ways, to help people who might have or be neurodiverse kind of find their way, understand kind of opportunities to learn more about that, and for companies to understand the benefits and opportunities of being more inclusive all around. Just there's a ton of benefits when you can take the best of the best ideas from all different kinds of people and do new cool things with that.
Yep. I was particularly interested in hearing about the masking and how that has changed over the years. On this podcast, we've talked about a lot of different kinds of masking.
Yes.
Whether you should or shouldn't. In fact, it might be the premise of the whole podcast if you should mask as
definitely
a human
a theme.
or not. Yeah. So anyway, have a listen. Thanks for joining and let's dive in.
Have a great one. Thanks, Al.
And we are rolling. Great. Hello, everybody. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good morning.
Day.
Good evening.
Whatever time it is for you. Hello, Jenna. Hello, Emma.
Hello, hello.
We are here today with Emma Zumpson. I'm saying it right, right? Emma Zumpson. Emma is a former consultant, now a student, and then will be a consultant again, but more a consultant of her choosing, right? Is that right?
Yes. I love that articulation of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Emma, we have brought Emma on today with kind of an interesting story about neurodivergence and how it shows up in the workplace or doesn't show up in the workplace. And we just wanted to have a conversation about that. So Emma, thanks for joining us today. Can you give a little, just a little summary of kind of the last year or so that has led you back to school?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned, I am and have been a consultant for a good portion of my 20-ish year career. The last seven of it has been in a large kind of consulting firm operating as a marketing expert, which is majority of my background. And over the last 12 to 18 months, as one hits their mid-career inflection point, I've done a lot of reflecting and, you know, kind of concurrently hit a phase of burnout that forced some of that reflection. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest factors there was my own neurodivergence. And I am an outlier in the kind of population of neurodivergence in that I was obviously a female, I identify as female, and was diagnosed when I was seven. So I have known about my diagnosis for 35 years, and that is fairly unique. Most women are not diagnosed until later in life, and you know, that's a journey onto itself. But for me, I have felt for most of my life that I have a grip on my neurodiversity. I've done a lot of therapy. I have meds I can leverage. I have tools in my arsenal. But the last 12 to 18 months kind of broke that all down. And you know, as I examined what was challenging me in the workplace, what I needed to be successful in the workplace, I realized, and also what was fulfilling me and exciting me in the workplace, I realized that I really love mentorship and coaching and helping people learn and develop skill sets. And I just wasn't able to get the kind of support and mentorship and development I needed as somebody who is neurodiverse and who is was struggling with my neurodiversity and the expectations of my kind of senior level role. So I did what any good ADHD person does and Googled a lot of things and spoke to my wonderful network of professional and personal peers and decided that it just felt like this was a gap that needed to be resolved. How do not only neurodiverse professionals get the support and understanding in a mid-career capacity? There's a lot of support for people who are entering a workplace just because of the generational patterns. But the folks who either are late in life diagnosed or who have carried this diagnosis, but social things are breaking apart for them, there's not a lot of support. And I think the bigger gap that I've recognized is that the companies, as well-meaning, like my company was incredibly well-meaning and tried to be supportive. There's just nothing, there's no proven research. There's not a lot of, resources to help them figure it out.
And
So,
you had mentioned
yeah.
there was also kind of an issue with them even knowing that that's what was going on, and you brought up the term masking.
And I think yeah, there's as I said, I thought I had a hold on my symptoms and the manifestation of my own neurodiversity. And I'm going to say something that I want to recognize is somewhat problematic by modern standards of neurodiverse treatments. But because of the way I kind of have made my world way through this kind of gnarly world, I was trained to mask. That is no longer the way that you are therapized as a neurodiverse youth. Today, there's a lot of other services and resources and support. I spent years with professionals training me to be socially acceptable and to control all of my symptoms. So those are things that I really rely on heavily, subconsciously. They're like muscles in my brain and body. And, for a very long time, they served me incredibly well until they didn't. And it appeared to a lot of people that certain of my capabilities may have been falling off a cliff or, not consistent. But all it was my ability to mask, my resource, my well that is required to draw on, to mask every day consistently, to meet the norms of my working environment was gone, was depleted. And the lack of knowledge about what neurodiverse burnout looks like, what normal, neurotypical, I shouldn't use the word normal, neurotypical burnout looks like, led them to not know how to support me or not know how to even say, hey, can we talk about this? I was just passed through really uncomfortable neurotypical conversations and standards and processes and things like that. And we eventually got to a really productive place in a kind of phenomenal dialogue, and they were really helpful and supportive of me making the choice to kind of make this pivot. But it wasn't easy. It took a lot of learning on both sides, and still, like a collective recognition that there's just huge gap in available knowledge on this topic.
Speaking of huge gaps in available knowledge, can we take a moment and just, I think, explain a little bit about what is neurodivergence? What does that encompass for someone who has it? What does it mean to the way somebody with neurodivergence kind of experiences or goes through life? Or I believe that there's potentially different ways of learning, different sensory considerations, but Emma, you probably know way more about it than I would, and would love to just kind of set the stage for folks who might not be as familiar with it.
And do you
Absolutely.
even describe it as you have it, or you are it, or
Oh, yes. Sorry.
no.
Those are two really great questions. There's a lot of questions in there. So I'll start with the definition of neurodiverse or neurodivergent. They mean the same thing. People have preferences regarding connotation between the word divergence versus diverse, but they typically refer to a group of neurological diagnoses that, as research and kind of familiarity and awareness of these disabilities have grown, it has become very, very clear that they are comorbid or they coexist very frequently, and they all are on spectrums. So it's really, really difficult to unweave the webs that they kind of manifest as. But it typically refers to either dyspraxia, dyslexia, dyscalculia, ADHD, autism spectrum disorder, and Tourette's. Sometimes, depending on the kind of person you're speaking to or the institution, they'll also include anxiety and depression. But all of this is still really nascent. The term was coined in the late 90s. But still, like, the research is so slim based on it, especially when you think about the population it affects. And Ellie, you asked about person first language, or, kind of, do I have or am I? It is really down to individual preference. It's much like asking somebody's pronouns when somebody, kind of reveals or discloses that they're neurodiverse. Either follow their lead with the language that they use, or you can ask. It's there's no one right way.
Sure.
It's the person's preference.
Got it. That's helpful.
And to answer your question about how it shows up, it shows up in a wide variety of ways. And one of the things, in particularly as it relates to ADHD, but commonly across that comorbid map, consistency is one of the biggest signals, or inconsistency, I should say, inability to regulate emotions or attention or physical kind of, status, things like tics and stims, coming and going, anxiety peaks and valleys. So the way my neurodivergence, and in my case, I am ADHD, autistic, and I have Tourette's, has shown up in a variety of different fascinating ways over my life. When I was a child, I had really, really apparent tics. I had a vocal tic, I had a facial tic. Kids loved it. I absolutely didn't experience any teasing when I was a child. But as I found communities and people that were really accepting of it, the pressure and stigma of it made it a lot less anxious for me. And so therefore my tics tended to settle down.
Oh,
So
'cause they're
it really
triggered by
triggered.
stress.
Triggered by stress, triggered by changes in environment, context, things like that. So for individuals, it can kind of come and go throughout your life.
Interesting.
Emma, how important or what do you think the impact is for people if who might be struggling with, some of the things that you mentioned and haven't gotten it diagnosed yet or haven't seen someone? Like, I guess, what is the impact, or do you see a particular benefit to having a diagnosis? Does that help you with tools to be able to manage it? Or I guess, what advice would you give someone who's like, oh, I wonder if neurodivergence is a part of how I'm experiencing the world or not?
Your diagnosis is just the start. I am somebody who is such a big believer in understanding your neuro makeup, whether or not you're neurodivergent. Understanding how your brain works is the most beautiful thing. It really helps anybody navigate challenges. And truly, once you get that diagnosis, a lot there are resources, there's tools, but I think purely just validation and visibility to other peers can be a huge inflection, especially, usually when you are questioning whether or not you're neurodivergent, you're experiencing some of that friction in life. You're either anxious about social interactions, you're getting feedback at work that you're late on things, or you're not showing up in a certain way, and you're internalizing it, and you're saying, I am less than, I am lazy, I am dumb, I am not as smart as my peers, something's wrong with me, I'm broken. And that's really, really harmful. That's really, that shame, that internalized feeling is horrible. And byproduct of it being internalized is that you carry that often as a single person,
You're
once.
alone. Yeah.
Other thing about, so diagnosis, it can be really, really hard to be diagnosed for a number of reasons. Access to proper care in certain metropolitan areas, the wait lists are years long to get access and, covered, especially the cost if you're not properly insured or poor insurance. It can be really expensive. In those instances, if that's somebody, if that is something somebody is experiencing, I would say do the research into self-diagnosis. There's a lot of people who talk about that and can like walk you through symptom trackers, various tools for you to use to self-diagnose, because while medicine is one path for treatment, there is a tremendous amount of behavioral therapy you can do. There's a lot of tools and tricks that you can leverage. TikTok is a phenomenal resource. The community there is amazing. And it can really start to turn the page on that sense of shame and stigma that you carry, and starting to understand there's others who are like me who are experiencing things that are similar, who I can learn from and I can talk to, and I can start to resolve a lot of these things. While it is a disability, I was reading something recently that really articulated it so well. It's not an absence of attention, it is a deficit. It is, you possess the ability to do all of the things. You possess the ability to sit still and make eye contact and control your tone and do all the things. And the more you understand where you're comfortable correcting those things and where you're comfortable setting boundaries and or articulating, I won't mask because that doesn't make me comfortable and I need to help have my community support me in that, the more you will find a lot of the restriction you subconsciously and in some cases consciously put on your behavior starts to relax and you start to evolve into a truer representation of yourself.
Yeah. I want to pull on a thread around the spectrums. So you mentioned that each of these things are on their own spectrum, but if you zoom way out, I think the big spectrum is actually includes neurodivergent and neurotypical. It's right. So because I
Yep.
think I have very rarely met somebody that was all the way to neurotypical, right? And I don't know. Maybe it's just it feels like everybody's kind of somewhere on this larger like spectrum.
Yeah. There are the it's an interesting topic. There's a lot of symptoms that are associated with neurodiverse diagnoses, like stims, for example. I have stimmed my entire life, and that has looked like rocking, that has looked like cracking my knuckles, playing with my hair, scratching my hands. I've had a lot of stims because my brain chemistry needs to do that to correct its chemistry. There are a lot of other neurological things that fall in other parts of the neuro landscape that also require stimming to kind of satisfy your chemical connections. So I think that's where the perception that, everybody has a little ADHD or everybody has a little bit of X, Y, or Z is socialized, but in reality, when it comes down to the actual neurological makeup and chemical signals in the brain that are associated with neurodivergent diagnoses, it's less of a spectrum. There's a pretty clear line of like, oh, you actually have the ability to produce dopamine in a regulated manner.
Got
There's a
it.
pretty clear line for your brain to do these things that, like one of the things that happens for ADHD brains is our neurons don't die off. In a neurotypical brain, as you age, only the strong survive. So your neurons, like the things that are making your brain work and fire, the ones that are serving you, that are helping you be successful or whatever, are the ones that win the fight. ADHD brains don't work like that. So there are like actual diagnostics that will help you determine where you land on the spectrum or on the
So,
kind of the bilateral view of neurotypical versus neurodiverse.
like the degradation of skills and knowledge, or like language skills, for example, like that degrades over time if you don't use it. Do you mean like if you learn language things, you can never unlearn
God, I wish that would be amazing.
it?
No. And this is where the complexity of neurodiversity, that's where within neurodiversity, there's all of these vectors. I think of it as like a spider chart. Hyperlexia is a really common artifact of neurodiverse people, people who do collect words, collect language, and their brain, because it is a dopamine release for them, they find satisfaction in it. Their brain will hold on to that. It's just the way our brains work. If it's something that's satisfying and interesting to us, like we were discussing a few moments before we started recording, hyperfixations. I've had many throughout my life, and I can still talk about them really, really comfortably. I have studied five different languages, and I could not, like, I mean, maybe visit those
No habla
countries and
español.
tourists. Yeah,
Yeah,
exactly.
my brain is a sieve for languages.
Right. But that's kind of like the magic of the neurodiverse brain, is they each have this really distinct
They're all
kind of
different.
thumbprint. Yeah.
You said something else. You said I shouldn't say normal and toggled over to the word neurotypical, and it got me thinking, like, why we say normal, and some of the other things you were describing make me think. I think it was when you were talking about TikTok and the community. You want to feel, I think it's easy to label it as I want to feel normal, but I don't think that's necessarily true. I think you want to feel seen, or like you're not all by yourself in experiencing some of these things. Is that, but normal is like, what does that even mean?
Yeah, and I think just in our family, for my kids in particular, we talk about the word normal a lot, because it's used casually, but ill-defined and carries a lot of emotional and social weight. And so whenever my kids use it, we stop and say, what do you mean by normal? Is it neurotypical, neurodivergent? Is it that's pretty and that's less pretty? Or is that, aesthetically pleasing versus not? Like, we tried to go deeper on that because I do think normalcy is a construct that is problematic unto
It's so
itself. But
subjective.
right. I mean, even the concept of like perfection is so false, yet controls so much of our lives. And I think the more you explore those labels or those concepts, that's where we start pushing on what's possible. That's where we, there's my sister and I, she's an educator, this fascinating conversation about phones in the classroom. And she hates having them in the classroom. And I was like, but sometimes for me to actually actively listen, I need to be doing this. There's like an app on my phone that I do this visual thing with my finger on it, because then I'm channeling my focus onto that, but my ears, my hearing is peaking. I don't have that phone on me, then I'm not going to be able to show up in the way that I need to, which is acquiring the information you're saying to me, but it's not normal.
I used to get in trouble in meetings for doodling. And the perception was that I wasn't paying attention. And I was like, I'm paying so much more attention because I'm doodling. Because my brain
100%.
would be like doing cartwheels and running through the forest or exploring space if it wasn't, at least my focus is here. So
And it's
the
one of,
perceptions of other people are really hard to deal with.
it's really, really hard. And it's when my son was diagnosed with ADHD in 2020, that's when I discovered neurodivergent TikTok. And I am not joking when I say I took a day off of work to deep dive and spent a considerable amount of that time sobbing, because when I was diagnosed at the exact same age that he was, and it was never spoken of. Like, my peers didn't know. We didn't, like, it was so stigmatized. It was so hush hush. Nobody knew. My teacher at the time told me I wouldn't graduate from high school, and my parents should consider residential learning for me because I wasn't
Oh my
going to ever
God.
be a successful student. Right. It was such a head, and I was so alone for years, especially as a woman. And I go into my son's classroom now, and they talk about their neurodiversity like Pokemon cards. Oh no, that kid over there, he's, ASD, and he's gonna stim, and that kid over there is ADHD and needs to be able to play with this thing during class time. And it's just like, that kid's got red hair and that kid's got blue eyes. It is a non-thing. And
Yeah.
it's just amazing. It's just amazing when I look at this generation and like have so much hope for what their experience will be of it and how they'll change things.
Yeah, that's cool.
And on a related note, I think we talked very, very early on in the beginning here about how right now you're going back to school, and then aiming to kind of go back into consulting. Can you talk a little bit about like what you're looking to do, and would love to dig into that a little bit.
I think my interests lie in two things. One, coaching and supporting. And this is something I'm already doing, neurodiverse people across the kind of career life cycle. So that's the part of this journey that is already well underway. The second part is to help organizations, particularly in relation to learning and development, less so on the accommodations and the more super paperworky side of things on HR's end, which is being well addressed, but thinking about the ways that professional environments can help support and develop folks, particularly for mid-career and up. Those are the folks who are, late in life diagnosed and dealing with a lot of extenuating circumstances that come with that and aren't able to grow and be as successful in many, many cases, as successful as they have been so far because this thing has happened. Or all of these wonderful kids in this next generation, I shouldn't call them kids, young professionals in this next generation who don't mask, who have had accommodations, who speak freely about these things, who are showing up in the workplace, and those workplaces don't know how to deal with them. They're like, well, we gave you noise-canceling headphones, and we let you work from home 3 days a week. What else do you want? Well, I would like to go to my annual training and have that training serve my disability and my needs as a different learner. I want to have some of the kind of manifestations or symptoms of my neurodiversity be recognized as we navigate this path forward. And that's where I want to help people and businesses be more successful. There's a lot of evidence now, that being more inclusive and empathetic to neurodiverse populations improves margin and revenue potential, increases retention by 90%. It doubles the, revenue generation from neurodiverse employees. So there's a huge business value and business proposition there, but there's just a lot of gaping into the void at this point, especially for people who are rising into executive roles, who all of a sudden, whether it's the pressure of that role or life, post-COVID's been pretty rough for a lot of
Yeah.
us neurodivergent folks, as well as the rest of the population. Like, how do we support them? How do we not just pass out the word burnout kind of absently without recognizing that word means something meaningfully different to a considerable amount of your population? And for context, globally, the kind of conservative estimates of neurodiverse populations is 1 in 5. 20% of the global population is neurodiverse. In the US, you're looking at for like the adult population for ADHD, 11% are diagnosed. They think that that actually is up in upwards to 13 or 15%. And the number for youth is much, much higher, obviously, because they're more commonly diagnosed point of life. So it's a considerable, I mean, that's like saying, I don't know how to work with anybody who comes from the state of Pennsylvania.
Well, I
Like, if
mean,
you're
you
from the
just
state of
can't.
Pennsylvania, like, we can only get you so far
They don't
here.
get you.
If you're struggling, we can't, there's not much we can do. Pittsburgh, Philly, the other parts, like, that's a huge part of the population. And it's going to become an increasing problem for companies in the future. So I want to help them understand how to adapt their services, their business models, their employee models to solve for that.
And how to really truly teach inclusivity, right? Which is something that we have really not mastered yet for any population that needs to feel inclusivity.
Correct. And especially that's a great challenge and problem to solve, because there's a lot of companies, I mean, especially like larger enterprises, that operate on the idea that you can treat a large number of people in the same way and it'll work. And so then there's real challenge in trying to think about how, okay, if there's like one or two cases of a different path or something, okay, but I can understand, especially for large population planners, just this wall of how do I plan a separate path for everyone and all of their unique needs, and still get everyone all the things they need. Like, it's like you said, there's more fluency, people are more comfortable talking about it, and now that's going to introduce a need to think differently. And I mean, maybe it's, find commonalities, or find like, here's what we can do that's the 80% that's going to be true for everyone, and here's the flexibility. But I can understand some of the challenge in how do we take this thing that more or less has at least gotten us through, capitalism, for the last 20, 40, 50 years. And like, especially in, current economic climate, like, how do we think about changing that? Because it's not just an edge thing, it's like a fundamentally core different approach.
But even
Yeah.
as you, even Jenna, as you say, they're used to treating a population or treating everybody the same and it will work. Work for who? Like, who, you know what I mean? Like, I think that companies are going to have to
For the
face this.
business.
Yeah, I know that, like, that's generally the answer, but I think companies are going to have to make this decision of kind of doing a mind shift there on who they want it to work for,
Right.
because they can go on it the way they are, but.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of facets of where the solution lies. I think it lies in services. I think it lies in pathing, concepts of career pathing. Not everybody's meant to manage people. That doesn't mean you shouldn't be capped out at a certain tier. That means that we can talk about a really meaningful and substantive and long-term career for you at a company, because we're willing to recognize that maybe you need to be generating IP that nobody else could generate versus managing people, because that's what some,
But everybody
white guy 50 years ago said was the most important skill. And I think that when businesses look at the business, the meaningful dollar value assigned to it, I mean, Microsoft does it. A lot of the tech leads, because of the tendency for, and I want to recognize I am oversimplifying here, but autistic people are commonly found in developer roles because there's a certain structure there that is really satisfying to the chemical and neurological makeup that they need and they excel with. So those companies that have recognized that this particular subsect of the neurodivergent workforce can really serve their goals super efficiently and to a degree of accuracy that neurotypicals maybe can't in a reliable way, they're setting some really beautiful standards. But this is a really complex group of humans, and ADHD folks tend to think in systems. So if you give me one tiny thing to focus on, I'm maybe going to do it, maybe not. But if you tell me I want you to fit that piece into the whole and like really help me understand how it all comes together, that's where my lights in my brain are going to start like, boop, 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 and I want to serve and, like, let's solve and let's fix. So there isn't one right way. And I think that a certain facet of solution is just pure awareness and empathy. If we think about this population about like the considerable amount of, Asian or countries that make up a similar population size as the global neurodivergent population, and how we have sensitivity. If you're going to go and work with one of those countries, you are trained in best practice. What are their cultural norms? How do they conduct business? What are their standards for success? That is, nobody questions that. They say, oh, we want to successfully work with these people. They have value to our company. We're going to do this. It's not different for your peers. It's not different for these folks whose brains work in a different way that still drives a considerable amount of value,
Yeah, the decision really should be, do we want to benefit from the different kind of creativity and thinking that these folks bring? Yeah.
And I
Cool.
think, some of the research shows they're more likely to be innovative. I think it's 2.3 times as innovative as their peers when you embrace and make inclusive cultures for neurotypical folks. So there's a lot of real value to be had, and it's going to be really hard and complex and challenging and murky, but that's where I get super jazzed. So
Well,
that's where this selection comes for me.
when you get through school and get the business rolling and hear how it's going.
Absolutely.
Sorry, I cut you off, Jenna.
No, that's okay. Similar vein. I like what you're saying, Emma, about a big part of it will be helping companies understand the benefits. Like it's not just a concession or a different thing that you're doing here. There are different opportunities on both sides, and here is what you could gain if you're willing to think through and address these situations in a new and different way. So it's really an opportunity for people to do better together, which is always good.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you know what the jar is, Emma?
I heard a little
Oh,
shake, shake.
do I know what the jar is? Yes.
The
Am I nervous about
random.
the jar?
You're
Sure.
nervous?
Oh,
Oh,
yeah.
really?
Oh, no.
The jar is so fun, though. Here,
It
let me.
is.
Today's question. Oh, that's a good one. What is something? Oh, I should say a lot of these questions are from our listeners.
Cliffhanger.
Excellent.
What is something you love to do, but don't do as often as you like? Mine is sleep.
That's a good one. That's a good one. I would say travel.
Yeah.
If I really had my druthers, I would travel for pleasure.
Are your
Although
kids
it's
good
not fun to do for
travelers?
work. My kids are great travelers. It was like the best. I didn't read parenting books and I just
Me
basically
neither.
ignored all the advice I got. But the best piece of advice that I took was get your kids used to car drives and planes as fast as
And
possible.
restaurants.
And I mean, restaurants is
Yeah.
still.
If you want to go to them, get them
Well,
used to it.
yeah. And my kids are great travelers, and so we do a lot of it. But God, I wish I had the budget to do way more.
That's awesome.
Where would you love to go, either by yourself or with your family?
If it was a first time place, I really, really want to go to Japan. So that would be a first time place. And if it was just a place to go back to, I love Scotland. I love, love, love Scotland. And I
Yeah.
could just go and be there for a while.
I would like
Love
to
it
go
there.
there. That would be
It's so
nice.
wonderful.
Would you ever live in another place or permanently or a year or two?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I come from a, like, my mom's side of the family is a bunch of weird hippies. So, like, they're all over the world. My, like, they're all expats. And so I'm very fortunate in that I can pick
Awesome.
up and draw myself in a couple of different locations in the world.
That's cool.
And to seeing how well they've done it and what color brings to the collective experience, I would
Yeah, you got
absolutely
it.
do it.
A
How about
global
yourself?
tapestry.
Yeah, would you do it?
Would I live abroad? Oh yeah.
Where would you go?
I would. I would probably go to Australia. Like I'd go to Australia in the in like the
The flip.
yeah, October through March time frame and live it up. I love Australia. It's quite beautiful. And yeah, New Zealand is green in ways that Minnesota just does. It's probably closer to Scotland. Like it's like the lime green
Yeah.
of just crazy greenness. It's incredible.
Super verdant. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Well, Emma, thank you so much for all your insights.
Thank
This
you
is
both.
awesome. Appreciate it.
Anytime, anytime.
All right. Thanks. Okay. I'm going to hit
Bye.
stop.
If you loved today's podcast, and I'm assuming you did, hopefully you learned something, hit subscribe so you never miss one of our episodes. You can also find us on professionalhumans.online, soundcloud.com/professionalhumans. You can find us on social media. Professional Humans is on LinkedIn. Ellie's on LinkedIn. You're also probably a professional human yourself and know how to use the internet, so you'll be able to find us somehow. Thanks for listening.